This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
High above our heads runs a fast-moving river of air. We call it the jet stream. This river flows, meanders, rushes by, sometimes splits. It is also known as the polar vortex, and for those in the northern hemisphere, the North Atlantic jet stream. Fluid in the atmosphere, paths of the jet stream move north or south in mere days, driving large changes in weather down below, and you felt it. When the jet stream trends north for a while, Spain can dry up and burn while Scandinavia gets more rain and snow. Famines in history are attributed to changes in the jet stream. But will this great wind track change along with the climate? Food systems and economies may depend on the answer. We cannot know what changes unless we know what it was before, but winds like the jet stream leave no tracks. Or do they? A team of scientists led by the American Matthew Osman found records reflecting the jet stream year by year in drill cores taken from Greenland ice. They are very helpful. Matthew B. Osman is a postdoctoral research associate at Climate Systems Center at the University of Arizona. Measuring characteristics of ice, Dr. Osman and his colleagues created a long-time map of winds, climate, drought, and rain since the Middle Ages and beyond, and we haven't had that before, and there are some surprises. Matt Osman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
How would you describe the North Atlantic jet stream that is a big part of your studies?
The jet stream over the North Atlantic is really just a small piece of a much larger ribbon of prevailing, fast-moving westerly winds that circles the Arctic. So these winds are often called the polar jet stream, which, you know, despite the fact that they're mostly situated in the mid latitudes, is actually a fitting name because what they effectively do is serve as a barrier between cold air masses that are situated to the north and much warmer air masses that are situated to the south. Now, I think the most important thing to understand about the jet is that it is far from being this stationary feature. It meanders, it buckles, it bends, and it breaks as it moves from west to east, and these individual changes tend to actually be responsible for a large degree of the weather variations that we see throughout eastern North America and Europe, not just on the day-to-day, week-to-week timescales that we see on our weather forecast, but also on much longer timescales.
To me, tracking upper-level winds over centuries sounds just impossible. How can ice contain that story?
Well, you know, I think that we're learning that fewer and fewer things are truly impossible in our quest to understand Earth's climate history. So it's actually a great question for exactly the reason that you state. So proxies of climate, such as those we find in polar ice from Greenland, are for the most part not overly sensitive to high-altitude changes in winds. So the reason we're able to recover this signal in Greenlandic ice seems to be due to the fact that winds associated with the polar jet stream actually extend all the way to the ground. Near the surface, the winds are weaker, but they're often referred to as the North Atlantic storm track because they're associated with the arrival of mild temperatures and increased precipitation. So what we were able to do in this study is leverage the fact that precipitation and temperature patterns across Greenland are quite sensitive to changes in the storm track and therefore the jet stream. So we analyzed variations in the amount of snowfall archived year after year in about 50 Greenland ice cores, as well as the chemical makeup of the water molecules that actually comprise those snow layers. And we could discern not just how much precipitation fell in a given year, but also about the temperatures that those air masses were exposed to back in time. So using this spatial patchwork of these signals, we actually were able to isolate an imprint of the jet stream during the past.
Well, this really matters to people in the U.S. Northeast and people in Britain and Ireland, of course. And Britain endured a few years of being the target of repeated storms. As recently as 2012, they were in this storm track. They couldn't get out of it. Are those things related to the jet stream?
I'll say it's a slippery slope, I think, to attribute any single weather event or even a small collection of events to global warming in and of itself, especially when you're talking about something as dynamic as the jet stream. But, yeah, it's my understanding that the extreme rains and flooding that afflicted Britain during 2012 were indeed the result of this anomalous southward meander in the jet stream and an increase in its intensity. in general here, Britain's location is at the perimeter of the North Atlantic Ocean Basin, so it makes it extremely susceptible to these changes in the jet stream. I will add, though, one of the really neat but somewhat sobering things to come out of our reconstruction was that we were able to go back and look at several past societal calamities in England and Ireland in tandem with our reconstruction of jet stream changes. So just as an example here, we found two of the largest famine events in Britain and Ireland occurred during the years being 1728 and 1740. And these years were associated with winds that blew at about half their normal intensity. And in the latter of these two events in 1740, it's actually estimated to have cost the lives of upwards of half a million people. Historical documents report these years as being unusually cold and dry, which is exactly what we'd expect from a strong diminishing in jet speed. And so, all said, what we're able to do is to begin to use our reconstructed results for the past millennium as a sort of prologue for possible future events.
In a PNAS paper published this September, your team analyzed ice records going back 1,250 years to the early Middle Ages. Did you find the jet stream has moved outside its historic paths in recent years?
Yeah, that's a good question. There does appear to be a slight northward trend in the jet stream's average position during the last few decades. But so far, its average location does not appear to be wholly distinguishable beyond the relatively large range of natural variability that we see in the jet, at least from a statistical standpoint.
We recently spoke with Dr. Judah Cohen, a forecasting expert at AER and MIT. His work suggests patterns of stretching, as he called it, in the polar jet stream can help predict mega snow events in the U.S. Northeast, as well as in Russia and northern China. You studied the changing paths of the polar jets. Do you think the waviness, the meandering, has increased in the last century or two?
Our study focused specifically on the zonal mean annual component of the jet stream. That is, we averaged across all longitudes of the North Atlantic for the westerly wind component for the entirety of the year. So there are actually some positives as well as some caveats to this approach. One positive is that our approach is quite intuitive. We can essentially boil down the jet stream's position and intensity for a given year as essentially one number each. So using this method, we in general don't find evidence in our ice core-based reconstruction of strong changes in intensity during the last 1 to 2 centuries. But when we think about quantifying waviness in a rigorous way, you know, my take is that it really requires one to look across two dimensions, so north and south as well as east and west. So I think it's reasonable to question whether our approach would actually capture changes in waviness. But that being said, one would suspect that any increase in waviness could lead to a decrease in zonal intensity. So overall, I would say that this is still very much an open area of research.
In a 2018 paper, climate Michael Mann suggested the jet stream would slow down with more ridges and troughs. And in your paper, you project that the North Atlantic jets may move north after 2060. Did I get that right? And how would we know if that was happening?
Yeah, you got that exactly right. So we looked at projections of zonal intensity across a large multi-model ensemble of climate projections, but we didn't see any clear evidence from this ensemble in a shift in jet stream intensity, at least in the same way that we see for changes in jet stream position. That's not to say there won't necessarily be changes in the jet stream's intensity in the future. It simply says that the models don't agree on this issue. The differences could very well be definitional, relating, you know, simply to how one defines jet stream intensity or over what time period. So, for example, as I'm aware, the Michael Mann study you mentioned, it focused only on summer changes. We studied the mean annual component, so different seasons could very well have different jet stream responses due to differing mechanisms at play. Quasi-resonant amplification is really just one. In either case, you know, my opinion is that this is really an area of research that demands much attention in the future.
Well, along with a group of very strong scientists, you measured even earlier times with a brand new paper just published in Nature. Your team mapped Earth's climate for the last 24,000 years since the peak of the last ice age, and there were surprises. Did the world warm gradually and evenly over the last 24,000 years?
No, it certainly did not warm in an even or even gradual fashion during the last 24,000 years. So on a global basis, we see essentially a three-part sequence during the last 24,000 years. So from 24 to 17,000 years ago, Earth is in this relatively stable, ubiquitously cold state. This is the last ice age. By 17 to 9,000 years before present, Earth enters a period of relatively rapid global temperature rise and ice sheet decay. This is known as the deglaciation. And finally, by the time that we get to about 9 to 7,000 years before present, the Earth does begin to enter this somewhat stable period where Earth's temperatures slowly warm towards the pre-industrial interval. So this is a period known as the Holocene. It's the period where human societies have flourished. It represents the world that you and I know today, or, you know, at least the one that our grandparents knew.
There are papers and articles saying the world warmed since the development of agriculture some 10,000 years ago. The presumption has been humans were already warming the world before the Industrial Revolution. Do we have to change that story?
Well, I'm not entirely sure the exact studies you refer to, but I can say this. What our reconstruction shows is that Earth probably warmed gradually during the last 10,000 years, probably by no more than a degree Celsius. From our analysis, though, it doesn't appear to be the case that we would necessarily need to invoke human influence to explain the vast majority of that change, especially in the early part of the last 10,000 years. Rather, what we see is that temperature changes during this period seem to be related to a reduction in sort of the residual component of these once vast northern hemisphere ice sheets.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Matt Osman from the University of Arizona. He led several new papers revealing past climate changes in the North Atlantic with lessons for our future. In another study published in Nature Geoscience this year, your team describes long periods of increasing snow on Greenland because of warming. Matt, how does warming drive more snow in Greenland?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's something of a tug of war that occurs when thinking about what causes an ice cap to either grow or decay during periods of warming. So warming can cause either growth or decay, right? So today we observe melting rates that are outpacing the rate of annual snowfall atop ice caps on an annual basis. But in past centuries, these ice caps would actually expand due to increased levels of precipitation brought about by warmer regional temperatures. The difference between the past and present appears to be quite simply just the severity of recent human-caused warming. You know, as we all know, right, the existence of ice in any environment is really threshold limited. If it gets too hot, it melts away.
In a way, what I'm hearing is that if our warming was not so severe, we might warm the climate a little bit. That would cause more snow to fall on Greenland, and that would balance out whatever melted off. But we've pushed it beyond that so that even with more snow, we're losing absolute mass from Greenland.
Yep, you've interpreted that exactly correct. Essentially, when we talk about this tug of war, it seems that melt in the last few decades has begun to win out over increased accumulation.
But the paper says, quote, "The ice core evidence could indicate a recent reversal in the response of West Greenland ice caps to climate change." Talk to us about that reversal.
So observations from satellites and ice cores, as well as model simulations, each of these things unequivocally show that the majority of Greenland's coastal ice caps are losing mass today. They're melting due to rising temperatures. So what we found in our study is that temperature rise and the loss of these polar ice caps actually may not have always gone hand in hand. For the particular ice caps that we studied using our ice cores, we found that within small degrees of warming in the past, these ice caps actually tended to grow. And this was because increased snowfall brought about by mildly warmer temperatures allowed them to do so. In the past, this increase in snowfall could outpace the rate of increased melting. But today, we're warming so much that it appears that the fundamental relationship between temperature rise and coastal ice cap growth has actually begun to reverse. So ice mass loss today from increased melting is outpacing the rate of ice mass loss from increased snowfall.
Scientists have been wrestling with something called the Holocene temperature conundrum. What is that, and has it been resolved?
The Holocene temperature conundrum reflects the stark discrepancy regarding how global temperatures responded or trended during the last 10,000 years. So model physics predict there should be a warming, whereas climate proxies by themselves have seemed to suggest that there was this long-term cooling trend. we've taken a stab at answering this approach and using our approach that combines models and proxies together. And our results really are quite fascinating. When we look at our own proxy compilation, what we find is indeed this clear long-term global temperature cooling trend. And this is what prior authors have also shown. But curiously, when you combine those same proxies with models in a way where the models are pushed to become more consistent with the proxies, what we find is a clear Holocene warming trend, which is similar to past modeling results. And we think this is happening for two reasons. First, our new approach actually explicitly models the seasonal response of the proxies themselves to climate. So this is known as a proxy forward modeling approach, and it helps us to account for the fact that proxies are usually biased towards a given season. We're essentially removing this bias in our approach. The second reason is, simply put, our results are truly providing a global average in this case. We are actually averaging all places on Earth instead of having to infer changes in places where we don't have proxies. So this is actually a really exciting result, and it suggests to us we're one step closer to resolving the Holocene temperature conundrum.
So just for our listeners, I gather that proxies are things that they may be like tiny animals that collect calcium. They may be what you measure out of a glacier borehole. But it's real-world information that leads to a proxy. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. These are real observations of climate before we have, you know, what we consider observations today. And I'll just give a quick example of this. So when we think about modern observations, one of the simplest examples that comes to mind is a mercury thermometer. But one of the ideas I actually might pose is that a mercury thermometer is, in fact, a proxy. All we're doing in this case is leveraging the physical association that exists between the expansion of mercury in a glass vial with temperature. And the proxy works in fundamentally the same way. We're leveraging some underlying physical relationship between a physical parameter or a chemical parameter of the Earth system that we can measure in an archive that extends into the past. And we can infer indirectly from those measurements a property of.
I was shocked to learn from your paper the world has warmed a little over 6 degrees C since the time of the big continent covering glaciers. That seems like a lot. Did I get that right?
You sure did. Listen, these changes are a lot, but they're not wholly unexpected. When we're talking about the last glacial maximum, 20,000 years ago, we're really talking about a world that was different than the one we know today. So sea levels were nearly 130 meters lower. CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere were less than half that of today. And we had these massive ice sheets that covered much of the northern hemisphere. So collectively, these changes imparted a huge offset in Earth's radiative balance. It was just a lot colder in the last ice age.
And you find changing greenhouse gases are not enough to explain that kind of temperature rise in less than 20,000 years. What was the other big driver warming this planet then?
So we found there are two main things that appear to have contributed to the temperature rise of the last 20,000 years. So the first is, as you mentioned, greenhouse gases. The second, however, is changes in albedo. Both of these were probably of general comparable magnitude in their contribution. We also see that other things were probably also important in explaining regional patterns, for example, ocean circulation and orbital changes during this time period. But albedo and greenhouse gases appear to explain over 90% of the global temperature change during this period. So this is an overwhelming majority, which is an important context to consider. Today, we've dramatically changed Earth's radiation budget for both of these components, primarily by releasing massive amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which I should also know as an aside is also causing a similar feedback where we're continuing to decrease the albedo in the higher latitudes due to the loss of sea ice and seasonal snow cover, even though these northern hemisphere ice sheets no longer exist.
In a Radio EcoShock interview, we heard most of the Greenland ice sheet melted away sometime in the last million years. Rock samples recovered from a deep military drill in the 1960s showed contact with air within that time period. Is that your understanding as well?
This is a little bit outside my expertise, but that's my general understanding, yeah. That particular sample came from Camp Century, I believe, which is only 100 kilometers inland from the coast, so I would say it's somewhat challenging to know just from this coastal site how much of the interior ice sheet was lost. But yes, it does suggest a good portion of the ice sheet was lost at least once in the last million years. It does raise a broader point, though, that I think more and more we're learning just how susceptible ice sheets like Greenland are to relatively small perturbations in the global mean climate. A good example comes from looking at a period known as the last interglacial. This was about 120,000 years ago. This is the last globally warm period similar to the current interglacial we live in today, so the Holocene. Our best estimates currently place global temperatures as being only slightly warmer during this period as in the pre-industrial, so perhaps only a little cooler than the early 21st century, but we have a fairly strong indication that the Greenland ice sheet was considerably smaller during that period than today. So the point is this, when you give an ice sheet enough time, thousands of years, it will adjust in a sensitive manner to changes in climate, and we can certainly expect that moving into the future.
So you say thousands of years. We needn't worry about Greenland suddenly cracking apart and falling into the sea in the next decade or six.
No, I don't think we need to worry about in the next decade or six, but it's something that should be on our minds when we think about these sort of centennial to millennial timescales moving into the future. It's going to be an ongoing problem, irrespective of continued greenhouse gas emissions at this point.
Can we say the ice records have never seen a climate change as fast as the one we humans are forcing now?
Well, it's a matter of context and perspective. So in the last 10,000 years, no, not to my understanding, not even close. If we go further back in time, we do see evidence of abrupt warming in the Greenland ice cores during the last glacial period. These are known as Damsgaard-Oscar events, otherwise known as DO events. And during these periods, Greenland is thought to have warmed by around 10 degrees or more over the span of decades. But these were probably due to regional, you know, sort of pseudo-catastrophic events, things like glacial outburst floods. So that's a lot of warming in a short amount of time, but that degree of change is probably localized in space. And moreover, each of these events is probably preceded by a relatively quick cooling back to normal, so to speak. So the important thing to get out of this is that the context of today is that we're pumping carbon into the atmosphere at a rate probably not seen on Earth in at least several millions of years. So we're performing this massive experiment on our planet right now. It's one that I don't think the Ice Core Archive, as old and informative as it is, can really provide a perfect analog for.
Matt Osmond, how much time did you spend on Greenland?
I've been lucky, or unlucky, I suppose, depending on your perspective. I spent collectively several months of my life living on various glaciers and ice sheets.
And you led several breaking papers in the last year or so. What do you hope to do next?
I hope to continue using these new methods, especially the ones that we've applied to understand the global climate evolution since the last glacial maximum. I hope to apply these same methods to deeper portions of Earth's rich climate history. We have, you know, potentially 4.6 billion years of history that we can look back on and try to understand and disentangle in a really fundamental way in order to inform our future. And so I look forward to pursuing these broader aims.
And we're just finished up the COP26 in Glasgow, and I don't know how successful that really is, but I wonder, what is the intersection between the type of new science that you and your colleagues are bringing out and the decisions that we as individuals and as societies will have to make? Do you see a nexus there? Is there something that drives directly from your work into our present problems?
Well, you know, it remains to be seen, Alex, I think, in terms of seeing what comes out of these recent studies and any forthcoming in terms of the societal response. One hopes that these results, which provide context and new understanding of the climate system across different timescales, one hopes that that context will be used in a fruitful way, I think, at a societal scale in order to allow us to affect positive change and move the climate system and therefore societies in a fruitful direction into the future.
Dr. Matthew Osmond, thank you for finding time for our listeners.
Thank you.
Radio EcoShock.
When the Soviet government dumped chemicals and atomic waste in the Arctic, they knew it would stay entombed in the ice. The first Arctic cities were built on permanently frozen ground, vast pipelines supplying Europe with natural gas this winter for heat and industry, They ran right across Siberia's frozen landscape. No one could believe the legendary land of cold could get warm enough to thaw. Now permafrost has lost its permanency, and half of everything humans built in the Arctic will need endless repairs or be abandoned. Over 3 million people now live in the Arctic. About a third of them are indigenous or local ethnic groups. The rest are settlers who came for mining, oil and gas, and lately for shipping. Almost all of them depend on fossil fuels to survive. The study Annette Barsch led, based partly on Copernicus' satellite's eye in the sky, found 38% of all new human development built on the at-risk permafrost is for the oil and gas industry. Human addiction to fossil fuels is the biggest single driver of Arctic incursions. The source and cause of climate wrecking for the whole world is expanding north towards the pole. We can't let that happen. In the Arctic, solar power can only work for a few months a year. The place goes sunless and dark for months every winter. Wind turbines can work in the Arctic, just as they currently keep turning at Antarctic bases. But these days, homes are heated with fossil fuels. Cars, trucks, and snowmobiles burn gas or diesel. Every industrial operation there needs them. Roads are paved with fossil fuels. Food, computers, everything is delivered by gas and oil. The harsh fact is, except for a few hunters and trappers, human development in the Arctic is more dependent on fossil fuels than anywhere else on Earth. Now we find burning those same fossil fuels means half of everything in the far north will need even more fossil fuels to repair or rebuild, in some cases, every year. And that unstable infrastructure is increasing as humans see the Arctic as a new frontier to plunder.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.